With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Ganhar três troféus. A bola está no Porto. Há um salto, Deco. A simular deu a bola para Darley. Vai dar para Deco. Vai levantar para a atenção. A Lenicheva tirou do pé da recarga e é gol!
Later tonight, President Bush is expected to announce the fighting's all but over in Iraq. He won't formally declare victory. He'll be addressing American troops from the deck of an aircraft carrier returning from the Gulf.
Celtic would get it back. The cross into the area. Henrik Larsson with the goal.
The English Football Association has been fined a record £70,000 by the European football governing body UEFA. It follows the racist abuse and pitch invasions by England fans during the match against Turkey in Sunderland last month. It had been feared fans might be banned from England's next home game as a punishment.
Five other players up in it, including Mielby, who comes here. Larsson again! He's done it again!
Ball on the floor, that's Musal, Max Pagana Perez, Douglas Ben, ninguém para empurrar, vamos na mais, bate, gol!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Spurler. Opposite me, as always, is Jonathan Wilson. And joining us on the pod today is Kieran Canning, football correspondent for AFP in London. Kieran, lovely to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now then, we go back to the UEFA Cup final in 2003. Celtic 2, Porto 3. Martin O'Neill against Jose Mourinho. Kieran, why have you gone for this game?
Having listened to some of your previous greatest game pods,
it tends
to be people choosing a game that of glory for their team, you know, a game that with great memories. So as a true Scotsman, I've gone for the glorious failure.
You know, I didn't think you were a Porto fan.
of Celtic getting all the way to the UEFA Cup final, first time that they got to a European final in 33 years. And it's just the memories of this season. It was the first time that I had a Celtic season ticket that year, and the route to the final, the games, the stories of, you know, the people that went to Seville, and the reported figure was 80,000 yeah. Celtic fans.
And they only had about 35,000 yeah, exactly, yeah. of the tickets. Yeah.
But yeah, it was just a great season. And it was a strange one in the sense that it's probably Celtic's greatest ever season in which they didn't win a trophy.
Yeah.
Because they get to, you've got final, lose an extra time to a team who then go on to win the Champions League the next year. They lose the League Cup final because they missed a penalty in the last minute. They lose the league on the final day of the season by a goal on goal difference. But it still, I think, as a Celtic fan, is one of the most memorable seasons that there's been.
Jonathan, you were at the final as well. Obviously, you talk about the game in the second half. But it was quite a monumentous occasion, and the Celtic fans played their part in that, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I've never experienced anything like that. I mean, it was pretty early in my career. And I suspect now I'd be kind of a bit more cynical and a bit more annoyed about all these people getting in my way and being drunk. But at the time, it was just extraordinary.
So you weren't always cynical?
Right. Wasn't always as cynical.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, even the plane, I remember kind of constant. I mean, I must have flown from London, but still, it was just full of Celtic fans and constant chanting all the way through the flight. I remember I flew out on the day of the game, and I remember getting to the hotel, which was right next to Batista Stadium, mm-hmm. and the game was being played not at the Sanchez Pizjuan or at Batista's ground.
Yeah.
But at the Olympic Stadium, which was miles out of town.
Yeah.
A stupid place.
Well, it's odd because when you obviously, I remember the game was in Seville, and you watch it and you go, hang on, I don't recognise that stadium. But of course, it wasn't either.
It was the Olympic Stadium.
Yeah.
Like a nightmare to get back from. Uh-huh. And it was roasting hot. It must have been high 30s, maybe even 40 degrees. It was so hot. And I got there around about lunchtime, and I remember saying to reception, what's the best way to get out to the ground? Because it wasn't obvious at all how you got there. And they said, I'll just get a taxi, but I'd go and get in the queue now. And so I was like, oh, I put my stuff in the room, went to get in the queue. And the queue stretched for miles. And for 2 hours, I stood in this baking heat, so slowly inching forward. And the whole city was in meltdown. They had no phone signal because, you know, just 80,000 people arrived. It completely overwhelmed the system. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting to within, I don't know, 20 yards of the front of the queue. So I'd been there, 2 hours. And this tall, grey-haired bloke just sort of gets ushered to the front of the queue. And I'm sort of, who do you think he is? I can't have this. And just about to say something, fortunately, he half turned. And I realised it was Billy McNeil. And I was like, okay, I think probably in this scenario, there is a man who's entitled to a taxi
this
before me.
Scenario only. Can he pull rank sort of thing in the taxi rank? But it was phenomenal support Celtic took there, of course. But it's interesting to say that you remember this season fondly. Was it really because of this UEFA Cup final, or was it the football that they were playing under Martin O'Neill? It was a great team with great players like Larson and so on.
Yeah, no, it was this run because obviously Celtic and Rangers are competing for the league mm-hmm. year in, year out. But it had been so long since Celtic had gone even beyond Christmas in Europe. It had been a long time. So to do that just seemed as being a big thing. And we often talk, and we'll go into the game later on, but we often talk about football, especially as football journalists, and we're talking in forensic detail about tactical innovations or the technical quality of games. But so much of it is why we all fell in love with it in the first place, is about the sort of shared experiences of it. And I sort of grew up going to football with my dad, and he was, as a young man when Celtic were great in the late 60s and the early 70s, and he would tell all these stories about travelling across Europe on, you know, going from the bus from Glasgow to Lisbon or to the final in Milan in 1970. So to get that sort of, you hear these stories and you think, oh, that's a bygone era. I used to wind them up constantly, like, you know, stop talking like it's, you know, 1960s. So to have that experience, and we couldn't go to the final because he was a school teacher, and I had four exams that week, so we couldn't go to that. But we went to the semi-final away in Boa Vista, and it was an incredible night because the game was terrible. It was one of the most awful games of football I think I've ever seen. But Larson scores with 10 minutes to go, Celtic go through. But the strange thing about it is, obviously, Porto have qualified for the final that night as well, and Boavista are from Porto. So you have, it was like a mini Seville in the sense that you had a, and it was a public holiday the next day, so you had all the Porto fans out on the streets celebrating. You had not 80,000, but maybe 10, 15,000 Celtic fans out there.
That's quite extraordinary the way that's worked out, actually. I didn't really sort of think about that.
Yeah, so, and I mean, I have friends and family that, you know, when we were there the night that Celtic went at Anfield, or, you know, went to Stuttgart or Celta Vigo. So it was just a such a rare, I mean, it's still a rare thing now when you look back, we're sort of 17 years on, and Celtic have never got anywhere close to another European final. I know Rangers have done it since then, but, you know, it's been a hugely long time since.
They say Manchester in 2008 was not the same as today.
It was slightly different.
The game was
different,
not the same
experience, but
the reaction was different.
Just what I mean by that is the sheer fact of a Scottish club getting to European final.
No, and there was the great. I mean, I was at the. I think it was at both legs of the game against Liverpool. I was at the Glasgow leg of the game against Boavista, and there was this great sense, and you don't get it very. You really don't get it very often in modern football. Of a club with a huge support, exploring new territory. Every new level is massively exciting. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense of almost disbelief that you're there or back there in Celtic's case. And that's a really rich thing. It's a really good thing to experience. And one of the things I remember from the final was everybody I spoke to, they were from all over the place. There were people from Canada, from South Africa. It was sort of, I guess... You know, the nature of history is that Celtic's diaspora is bigger than most. Mm-hmm. And everybody suddenly focusing on this one city in southern Spain. It was a very sort of moving experience to be part of that.
Yeah, and that really made the final, from my memory, because people were quite dismissive of the UEFA Cup. Obviously, it wouldn't last very long as the UEFA Cup. It would become the Europa League, but people were beginning to be a bit dismissive. The Cup Winners' Cup has already gone.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they were as dismissive of it as they are of the Europa League now. I mean,
the slide was happening.
The Dortmund final had been a great final.
Yes.
The following year, you had the Rafa's Valencia beating Marseille in Gothenburg, which is also a great occasion. I actually really enjoyed covering the UEFA Cup, partly because you got these stories like Celtic of this, a proper cup run in a way that is almost unimaginable these days.
Yeah, but it was a great cup run, and don't forget beating Blackburn Rovers. Would I be right in saying Graham Souness's Blackburn Rovers?
Yes, that.
Which would have been a particularly enjoyable one for some of those Celtic fans. Well,
Graham Souness is obviously a very respected figure amongst the Celtic fan base, isn't he? And I remember the first game was in Glasgow, and Blackburn were a very strong team at the time. You know, they'd Duff and Tugai, York and Cole had gone there as well. And Blackburn were the better team on the night. But as so often on this run, Larson scores the winning goal towards the end of the game. And Souness comes out afterwards and says it's men against boys, you know, and we'll sort them out once we get down the road in a couple of weeks' time. And that sort of men against boys comment sort of stuck, because obviously the press made a big thing about it. Larson even commented on it after the second leg, you know, that there was a lot of talking from Souness after the first leg when Celtic knew they hadn't been at their best but had still managed to get the result. And then going down to Blackburn and winning 2-0, and not just winning, I think the fact that because the performance hadn't been great in the first leg to actually go there and dominate was a huge thing, because I come back to this thing it was a huge thing for the Scottish game although it's Celtic against Blackburn, so in terms of the size of the clubs there's a big difference there. Just for a Scottish team to go down and beat a Premier League team was a huge thing. And
then when you said men against boys, did he mean physically, or I mean, it seems extraordinary. No,
just played them off the park. Okay. Was his interpretation. Right.
It's more of an expression, I think, north of the border. That one is basically say we were much better than them.
Right.
It's not usually to do with the physicality.
Yeah, because I mean, I just sort of remember. I really enjoyed not just this season, but the couple of seasons after that when Celtic. I remember the game when they beat Lyon 2-0 was a. This is the selfish journalist point. It was a great thing to cover, because you could get to the station and get the train, get the sleeper back to London afterwards. So you know, weirdly, you got home earlier from doing a game in Glasgow than you did a game in, say, Manchester or Liverpool.
Okay.
And it, you know, just a nice thing. It was always a bit of a rush to get on the sleep. Once you're on the sleeper, a couple of drinks, go to bed. 7 o'clock, you've woken up and you're at Euston. Brilliant.
Jobs are good.
But also just the Celtic Park on those nights, the football that they play, the sort of the power and the dynamism of it, the 3-5-2 with Thompson and Agat, pinging cross after cross after cross for Sutton and Larsson.
Yeah. Well, and Hartson was in the side as well, although he didn't play in the final.
Was it both legs against Barcelona as well? Was that the following season?
Yep.
Yeah. And they were two extraordinary occasions. The game at Celtic Park, there'd been some kind of mess up with my accreditation. So they ended up just giving me a ticket in the stand behind the goal on my laptop. And I don't know if you remember that game, but at half-time, Rab Douglas and...
Motta was sent off.
Oh, yeah.
And then just after
fighting in the tunnel, just after half time,
Saviola got sent off.
So we, Saviola, there's been no announcement to say that there's been red cards at half time. And so, or if I had, like me and people around.
No, there wasn't. I remember just David Marshall coming out for the second half and people thinking.
Well, I was at the opposite end to that. So I didn't even realise that it was David Marshall. And so when Saviola's sent off, I'm sort of, I've got my notepad out. How have they rearranged it? I'm missing a player. I've seen nine of them. What's going on? I said to the bloke next to me, he's just like a fan. I said, is it just me? And Barcelona, you've got nine players on the pitch. He's like, yeah. So I rang Kevin McCarra, who was in the press box from The Guardian. I said, Kevin, what's going on? How come Barcelona, you've got nine on the pitch? And he went, oh, yeah, the Douglas and Motta were sent off at half time. But like people around me, I mean, I was then able to tell people around me, yeah, this has happened at half time. Mm-hmm. And then that away leg when Marshall was brilliant, Kennedy was brilliant that night, obviously before he got the horrific injury.
Yeah. The thing with the sort of rollercoaster emotions of this season is that it actually starts with a massive disappointment, because the reason Celtic are even in the UEFA Cup is because they lose to Basel in the Champions League qualifiers. And it was a very...
So yeah, we're back on 2002-3 now, which is a good thing. Carry on.
The strange thing about this UEFA Cup run is the away performances are so strong when historically Celtic are always very good at home. Yeah. But terrible away from home in Europe. And that was certainly the case of a lot of Anil's time there and the managers who followed him and did well in Europe. Because the season before, they'd been in the Champions League and won all three home games against Juve, Porto and Rosenborg, but lost all three. And that's why they didn't go through. So there was a bit of history there with Porto already from the two games in the Champions League the previous season. And Celtic, I was away at the Porto away game the year before, and Celtic got absolutely battered. I mean, it was 3-0, but it could have been many, many more. So that was the sort of the strange thing to flick the switch of going from being a team that's always hard to beat at home, and then the seasons that followed, the Champions League form was always built on Celtic Park being a fortress. But for this particular run, they go to Blackburn and win, they go to Liverpool and win. Although they end up losing in Stuttgart, they're 2-0 up, so they're 5-1 up on the tie and kind of switch off a bit in the second half, and then go to Bovista and win as well.
Yeah, and going back to that Liverpool time, you said going down to Blackburn was a big thing. Absolutely it was, I get that.
So Liverpool was a quarterfinal.
Yeah, so to then go down to Liverpool, a lot of people, perhaps south of the border, would be thinking, oh yeah, they've had a good run, Celtic, but they've probably come to the end now because they're playing one of the big boys, and of course they go and win.
And being at the first leg as well, Liverpool were marginally the better team, but you could see the good players that they had. I mean, Gerrard was great that night. They had Owen and Heskey up front. Risa was very important in the goal they scored. So yeah, having come away from Celtic Park with a 1-1, they were the favourites going into that second leg. And the weekend before, I mentioned that Celtic lost the League Cup final to Rangers. That was the weekend before the Anfield game, so they were also going into that game in a bit of a low. So to come away with that performance and that result, and yeah, it goes back. Yes, it was Blackburn, but more in terms of a Scottish club going down to not just a Premier League club, but one of the big Premier League clubs, and laying down a bit of a marker.
Yeah, they did what Hearts couldn't do, of course, which was win at Anfield, but they were mightily close. All right, after the break, we'll talk about the game itself. See you in a moment.
Indeed, Larsson scoring to tie the match at two. Celtic back on level terms, and again, a quick reply after the Porto goal. Larsson with a strong header.
Hold up. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
And the second yellow gives him red. That was trouble for Celtic. They were down to 10 men as Durley foul, goes for the flight, and Balde, he would head for the showers.
Welcome back to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Right, gentlemen. So, yes, Celtic are in the final. Porto, of course, beat Lazio in the semis, which would have surprised perhaps a few people. Not Mr. Mourinho, who was in charge. And when we come to Seville, Porto were favourites, understandably. And for my money, and I'm sure for a few other people's, this is probably the first time we saw Mourinho, really. I know he'd been making waves around Portugal.
Yeah, and I think that semi-final was a pretty early indication of the man he is. So Porto were 4-1 up in the first leg when Lucas Castroman, the Argentinian midfielder from Lazio, goes to take a throw-in, which might initiate a break, and Mourinho leaps from the bench and knocks the ball from his hands.
And this is Bond villain Mourinho, isn't it?
For which he is banned from the touchline for the second leg. So he sits in the stand at the Olympico.
Texting away.
Talking to... Well, no, he doesn't do any texting himself. Oh, he gets AVB to do his texting.
Oh, phone. Okay, right.
AVB and another assistant.
Yeah. AVB was very thankful when Siri came along.
And texting the bench. Now, what's extraordinary is there's a biography of Mourinho by Luis Lourenço. Which I think it certainly came out in English in 2000. It must come out in Portuguese in 2004 as well. It certainly came out in English in 2004, and it just lists all the texts.
Yeah,
there's no.
He's not happy with Deco's performance, if I remember correctly.
So it's on the one hand, it's extraordinary because you see the sort of the detail. How meticulous, that's the word. His thinking is, but at the same time, I mean, this biography is obviously written with Mourinho's help. You know, there's a lot of inside stuff there. There's no shame about blatantly cheating, as we then saw in the game.
Yeah, I mean,
it's one of them. I mean, watching it back, you know, when you're actually at a game, I'm always slightly uneasy about the sense of, I mean, while not a Celtic fan in any way, I clearly wanted Celtic to win that game. I'd sort of been caught up by that sort of the mood of that run.
Even I had as well.
But
I think mostly, unless you were a Porto fan, the way the game panned out, the way the Celtic fans were, there's all that.
But that's my point. I was there, because of that. I then sort of think, am I overreacting to the play acting, to the
shithousery?
The shithousery. No, I wasn't.
No.
Watching it back, it is one of the greatest shows of shithousery you've ever seen. The Vitor Baia sort of 4 minutes down injured towards the end of extra time.
Well, yes.
I mean, it's just unapologetic, extraordinary.
So, I mean, Porto that season, they won the league in Portugal and they won the Taça de Portugal. So it was a sort of hat-trick of sorts that they completed. So it was an impressive season.
They were a really good side.
This is the thing. That's why it's a shame that we've had to say all that. But you have to say that because it was so blatant. But they were an excellent side, as they would prove the following season, of course. But Mourinho's got them well-drilled, as you say. They've got some excellent players in there. I mean, it's lovely to go and watch Deco play again. You know, what a player he was.
And his little ball for first goal is... second goal, actually, as well. Yeah.
Even watching it back, just there's a... The first half is... There's not a lot of chances in it. I think the conditions played a part of it in terms of the pitch isn't great. Mm. The heat that you mentioned.
Well, the heat, I mean, actually, that was really dangerous. You know, it's an open stadium. Mm. The sun is baking down. These are Glaswegians. These are not people used to the sun.
But these are Glaswegians, Kieran.
But when you look at it on TV as well, when you talk about how prize tickets were, and it looks like there's empty spaces just because at the front of the stand, empty seats.
People in the shade.
But people were just moving back because, they were just baking. So.
And they ran out of water in the stadium so 2 or 3 hours before kickoff.
Prepared. Seville wasn't prepared.
But also in a situation like that, you shouldn't be charging people for water.
No.
It's dangerous.
But I think at the time, I mean, Seville is it's a magnificent city for anybody to go to as a tourist. But actually, it's not actually been that long since your more flight routes have opened up to it. So back in those days, actually, it was not really that firmly on the tourist map. So I don't think that they were prepared. That's a wider point.
It got the boom with the Expo in 1992, I think.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, you're right. But also, I just think the number of people. It's a bit like Istanbul in 2005.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things, you're right. It's the sort of romance of Europe that we hear about of... I mean, obviously, I was about to say, we hear about it from our fathers. My dad never saw something in Europe. he did in 73-4, but two games anyway. But, you know, those stories of the 60s of Celtic fans and United fans making these long slogs across Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Liverpool fans in the 70s even. Mm-hmm. You know, that is not a thing our generation has ever had to deal with. But Seville and Istanbul, you kind of got a sense of what it must have been like. People kind of taking extraordinary routes,
But two cities like that as well, that again,
flying to Barcelona and driving to Seville, hiring a car and driving down, or taking trains across,
But it's Seville's far enough away for it to be quite exotic. And of course,
it's an exotic city. It's a very unusual, different city.
It's a phenomenal city.
One of the sort of funny stories of, so when Celtic win the game against Boa Vista, they come back and they play Rangers away, and it's a big game in the league. And Celtic fans all turn up with like lilos and beach balls and stuff, like throwing beach balls onto the pitch. You know, unaware that there is no beach in Seville.
I was about to say, it's not on the coast, but the point stands.
Yeah, exactly. It was Spain, so there was going to be a beach.
Totally, yeah. So the game gets underway, and in those conditions, you know, John Hartson's not playing because he's injured. So you've got Larsson and Sutton up front. And Larsson, I mean, scored 44 goals in all competitions that season. He was on 199 Celtic goals, I believe, going into that game. We talked about the Porto lineup, and they had a little lad up front called Derlei, who would feature quite heavily for good and bad reasons throughout the game. But you're right; I don't remember too many chances, or there weren't too many chances in the first half. But would you what was the feeling among the Celtic fans as you at home watching, or where you were sitting, Jonathan, as the game starts unfolding itself, thinking, "Hang on, we're holding our own here," or is there?
Yeah, I think it was the nerves of watching it back now. I think Celtic were actually in the game much more than I had thought of the night, because I think you've just got those nerves of thinking, oh God, what's going to happen? And Porto did have a lot more of the ball. But it wasn't really until when you mentioned Deco earlier on that, yes, the pass of the first goal is very good, but there's a moment just a few minutes before where he sort of flicks the ball.
Oh, he chests it.
Up over Valharen, I think it is, and then sort of speeds past Baldi. And goes through and goal, and Douglas makes a save. But that's almost the sort of moment the game sort of clicks into life. Yeah. And he really starts to take control.
I have to say,
of
within about 20 minutes, I would happily have put my house on Balde getting sent off at some point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's by Balde for it, you know. And it's just, when you see some of the sort of the pace and the agility of the Porto players. So the first goal comes along just before half time, and it was that man, Derlei, who got on the end of it. And it's always a crushing blow to lose a goal just before half time, especially when you're the weaker side.
Yes, I mean, it's a Deco chip over the top. Alenichev has sort of managed to sort of... I mean, Lenishev's, I think, an interesting player. And he sort of was a winger, and then he ends up playing sort of on the left of a diamond. Mourinho's Porto would play a 4-3-3 in the league, but they'd play a diamond in Europe.
Why do you think he did that?
I think just to get an extra midfielder in there. I think, you know, the nature of the opposition Porto faced would be that they in Portugal, they play teams who sat deep, so you just get width.
Sure.
Whereas this allowed them to control midfield a bit more. Mm. So yeah, Deco's chip over the top, Alenichev with a volley, Douglas makes a save but can't sort of push out of the danger area, and Derley coming in, or Derley.
Derley, would it be?
I don't know.
Okay.
The interesting thing about Derley is because he also has a pretty prominent role in the next season when they win the Champions League, but when you look at that Porto team and what they went on to do, like players like Deco and Paulo Ferreira and even like Maniche getting big moves, Derley never really goes anywhere from that Porto team. He doesn't go on to bigger things. And he actually ends up, I mean, for all Larsson's heroics, he ends up as the top scorer in this competition because he scores the two goals to sort of march Larsson's
down. Yeah. And how are you pronouncing his name, Kieran?
I'm called Derley.
All right.
Well, let's see with Derley.
I wouldn't say what he was being...
Yeah, well, yeah. Indeed.
The pub I was watching the game.
We may well come on to that. So yeah, 1-0 at half time, but Celtic's fans still in good voice. But they get a goal 2 minutes after the restart, of course, and a fantastic header from Larsson.
This is one of the greatest headers, I think, I've ever seen.
A great cross as well, but yeah.
A combination of the occasion, obviously. Larsson was always one of these guys. He was an incredible header of the ball for his heights, you know, the spring that he got. But in this one, it's an almost impossible angle. The way he gets above the marker and sort of like hangs in the air and then finds, yeah, just the perfect sort of balance of the cushion on the header with the right accuracy to take it across Vitor Baia, you know, kisses the inside of the post and goes in. And it's one of, I mean, he scores two goals and two incredible headers, but that one in particular, and watching it back, all his sort of link-up play, he's not been given a great amount of service. It's one of the best performances of someone in a losing European final, I think, I've ever seen.
Yeah, and it was great for him to score those two headers, because when I think of Larsson, and perhaps when others do as well, I don't think of him as heading the ball. I think of him doing a lot more. But of course, in that game, which is where perhaps a wider audience would have seen him.
But he had everything, didn't he?
Oh,
That's the thing about him, that, you know, he was one of those complete forwards who, yeah, okay, if he'd had 2 or 3 inches more in height, then maybe he would have been more of a sort of target man type player, but he could score any type of goal.
Yeah, so I'd imagine it was pandemonium in the Celtic end, you know, when that.
Yeah, I mean, the press box, because I mean, clearly a lot of people got in without tickets as well. So I remember I was sat next to Paddy Barkley, and I was sat next to, I think, Dennis Campbell from the Guardian, who was very obviously a Celtic fan.
Yes.
He was in agonies, but he was their sports news guy. So he wasn't writing live on the game. He was there for the sort of the occasion, but there was also before kickoff. I remember a father and his kid who's, I don't know, like 11 or 12, sort of, you know, sort of edge into the press box. And sort of Paddy is very kind of, have you got accreditation? Who do you think you are? We've got to work in here. And his dad's like, no, it's just too busy over there. I kind of, he's scared. Mm. So Paddy's like, okay, stay here, shut up. First people out with you, I'm getting a steward. And I remember them being next to Paddy. And their sort of restrained excitement because they were terrified of Paddy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was pan. I mean, the stadium was 4-1, 5-1.
Yeah.
Celtic.
Well, the capacity is what, 52,000, I think.
Right.
And they reckon that Celtic had 35,000 of the tickets, which is quite odd because normally about 52,000 Celtic would probably get about 18,000-19,000 of that, something like that, with the usual split.
What's even changed in the sort of 17-year sense is when you go to European finals now, that the shame of it is how few, like even when you take into the account the size of the stadium, so many tickets are reserved for dignitaries and sponsors.
Well, that's what I mean.
Whereas there wasn't quite that same level of...
Oh, was it not that...
Of tickets reserved for that type of thing back then. There still was a bit... But it was more the fact that I'm not even sure if Porto took up their full allocation, which is why Celtic got such a large portion of the tickets.
Yeah, but they were, as you say, clearly outnumbered the Porto fans. Anyway, it's 1-1, and then on 54 minutes, Porto take the lead, and the pass from Deco
is well wasted,
so nonchalant, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. Absolutely glorious.
Yeah, I mean, from a Celtic point of view, you'd say both the first two Porto goals came from that space just sort of between Valhavn and Didier Gat. So that was, I don't know if that was something to do with the way Lenichev was moving or whether that was a perennial weakness, but yeah, that's the route that both goals come from. But it's, yeah, it's just...
The thing for Celtic, though, is they're not often coming up against a player like Deco.
No, of course not.
But... And so it's very difficult, especially in that heat when you're running around and so on and so forth.
But yeah, perfectly weighted pass. Yeah. Lenichev runs on and smacks it past Douglas.
Nice finish, yeah. But then three minutes later, it's 2-2. Larsson scoring another header, Kieran.
And this was a hallmark of those O'Neill teams because he liked to build sort of big physical teams. We talked about the centre-backs there. I mean, the thing that they lacked was pace because they were all giants. You know, Mjalby, Baldi, Valhaaren. You had normally you would have Hartson, Sutton. This occasion, it was just Sutton. And then Larsson, who wasn't the tallest, but this is an incredible spring that he shows again for the second goal. And Alan Thompson or Petrov, depending on which side it was on, with the delivery. So at this point, I think once it goes to 2-2, there's a 10-15 minute spell, which is the most confident I can remember being. And you can hear in the Celtic fans in the stadium as well that we're thinking, right, come back into this game twice now. Now it's now ours to sort of go on and take on. And in retrospect, when you look back, we've talked about Mourinho. For a Mourinho side in a European final, to take the lead twice and be hauled back again.
And so quickly as well.
Yeah, that you know, mentally, that was such a big boost to go, to, you know, the way the game went, to go be level, have the blow of going back down again and then come back again. And then from this point on, after that sort of flurry of goals until the end of the 90 minutes, seesaws back and forth. Again, there's not a huge number of clear-cut chances, but the sort of momentum of the game is going with Celtic, and I think towards the last maybe 15 minutes, they tire a little bit, and then Porto start to come back on top again.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that's the issue of tiring, I think, is part of it. I think there's also, Celtic were clearly a bigger team than Porto, and the fact that both goals come from headers, okay, they're Larsson headers, and first, the second one, yeah, sorry, the first one particularly is a very sort of skillful header. But it's almost as if that's what triggers Porto's play acting. And, you know, Mourinho has this idea that his job as a coach is to condition his players to make the right decisions in the right circumstances. So I don't know if he gave an order, whether they sort of automatically began to do that because of that sort of, you know, the sort of brainwashing that he instills, that they sort of knew that, okay, we can't fight them, so we've got to start making sure we get free kicks for this.
But the thing, looking through the stats as well, there was 57 fouls in the game, which, I mean, I know it's 120 minutes, not 90, but it was also at that time in European football where referees were blowing up for almost everything. That was the sort of, the diktat was going much more towards the way the Spanish or the Portuguese game is normally refereed, and then it kind of swung back a bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is Lubos Mikel, the Slovakian, but yeah. I mean, he completely lost control by the end, Nico.
I mean, might I read out a little section from the minute-by-minute which Barry Glendening was on in The Guardian. Durla goes down under a challenge from Mjalby. He clutches his ankle and starts rolling around like a pig in muck. Get up, you girly ponce. Now, maybe that type of language was, you know, should have been...
different age.
Yeah, exactly. a different man. But I'm only joking, Barry. But, you know, it shows you that people were getting so fed up, certainly the neutral, which is why I think... if people hadn't already got on board with supporting Celtic for the fans, for the run, they would have been. Because I just remember watching that game going, for crying out loud. It stopped, starts, it was interrupting what was a good game of football.
But I also think, watching it back, that could have backfired on them, not just because the game becomes stop-start and we talk about Celtic tiring in that heat. That actually quite often gives Celtic a bit of a break to, you know, get a breather. But also... Larsson was such an intelligent footballer, but he's kind of cottoned onto this and he's buying fouls himself at the other end. And Celtic were such a threat from set pieces that was always going to be one of the more likely ways that they could win the game. And I can remember once the game goes into extra time and then Jonathan's bet comes up and when Bobo gets his
he didn't get booked till the 80th minute, which seems to me remarkable. I don't know what that was for, but then the second one is a bookable offence on Durla.
That's right.
Who makes sure that Lubos Mikel notices it, should we say?
Yes.
But this was also a game with a silver goal. So
yeah.
If a goal had been scored in the first half of extra time, it would have ended at the first half of extra time. and Celtic get a free kick in stoppage time in the first half of extra time. And I remember thinking, I think for the first time in the game, I was like, this is it. We always score from corners and free kicks. You know, we're playing against a team of midgets. You know, we've still got two of our big three centre backs. And the ball comes in from Thompson. Vitor Baia comes out, clutches it, and actually stays on his feet for once. But that was that. And yeah, once it goes into again, watching it back, there's not a host of chances either way. But the one thing that held the Celtic team back quite often was not having a great goalkeeper. And we spoke about with the first goal where Douglas makes the save, but he doesn't really get enough on it, and it's still in a danger area for Derlei.
It's one of those where it's not a blatant mistake, but you do wonder whether a better keeper might have been able to push it more out to the side.
And similarly with the winning goal, the third Porto goal, ball gets played through, I think, by Manish, and he comes off his line. And it's one of those you see, you know, 90 times out of 100 where the keeper just comes, clutches it, the attacker jumps over him, but he kind of spills it back into the danger area. Derlei gets it. And then almost by trying to recover the situation, he makes it worse, Douglas, because Derlei has the shot. He kind of half gets a save on it, but it actually just pushes the ball into the ground and back up and makes it more awkward for
and then
Mjell
be on the line.
I think it was Larsson because Valhárn had gone off by this point, which I can't remember in the game, but I think it was reading the reports, it was because they feared that he was going to get sent
off. It was such an unfortunate one to concede. And even when Derlei hits the shot, like, it could, as you say, bounces around. It's one of those agonising ones, 5 minutes from the end.
I mean, it is, for all that, we're talking about this from a very Celtic perspective, sure, for good reasons, I think. Uh-huh. But as a goal to an European final, it is a classic goal in that it takes sort of two hits off defensive players.
It
ends up somehow in the roof of a net. It's those beautiful black nets they used for a while, which sort of give it sort of this air of exoticism. Mm-hmm. The sort of Celtic players sort of strewn about the box. The aesthetic of it is magnificent.
And that was the game over, really.
Oh, completely.
I mean, they were exhausted. They're down to 10 men. To be honest with you, they would have taken penalties, I think, especially when they went down to 10 men. I know penalties, who would have known? I mean, you probably have still fancied Porto for that, but it's a question. We'll never know that one. But they would have certainly wanted their chances. And the game finishes and Porto celebrate and so on and so forth. And Derlei was given man of the match. And Barry Glendening, on the Minute by Minute, had this to say about that. He said, Derlei takes the man of the match gong. And I want to say this because this is the feeling. You know, this is a national newspaper from a national treasure in Ireland, I assume. Derlei Silva takes the man of the match gong, which is a shame because despite his undeniable skill in front of goal, he's a horrible little play-acting tramp. Awarding him the man of the match trophy will only encourage him.
Well, and but the worst bit of play acting is, as you alluded to before, is Vitor Baia, who comes out and claims the ball and then goes down and rolls about for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Lewis Mikkel added 4 minutes. 4 minutes of injury time in a 15-minute half.
Yeah, I mean, that's
a quarter.
It's mental.
And even that felt like it wasn't enough.
Yeah. Oh dear. But Porto won the game. And as Porto were favourites and Celtic hadn't been in a European final for so many years, and it was such a great surprise that Celtic went all the way. Obviously, it wasn't a victory, but they had given such a good account of themselves. And because of the shithousery from Porto, there was a great sense of pride among the Celtic fans.
Yeah, definitely. Again, watching it back, I remember this at the time. The first thing you hear when the final whistle's blown is the Celtic fans singing over the top of Porto fans celebrating. There was a huge sense of pride. Even as I said at the start of the pod, the fact that this is one of Celtic's best ever seasons in a season where they don't win anything. Mm-hmm. The only sort of caveat to that, I think, is that there was also a great expectation that this was going to be the launching pad for something better. They were going to go back into the Champions League and hopefully not win it like Porto ended up doing. But when you see that Porto side go on to win the Champions League, there was a genuine belief that Celtic can go now to last 16 quarterfinals for a couple of seasons. And that didn't really happened, and that was the great sort of disappointment.
You still had the next season, that the draw against Barcelona in the Camp Nou.
Well, back into the UEFA Cup, because the Champions League, they go out in the group stages to Bayern and Lyon. But again, looking back on it now, when that draw came out, it was like, oh, it's tough, but you know, doable, because it was Bayern, Lyon, and Anderlecht. But then that Lyon team went on to be much stronger than people thought.
The 2-0 win at Celtic Park was, I mean, one of the best games I've ever been at. Aidan McGeady announcing himself to the world. But I mean, I remember the night of this final. It was an incredible night in Seville. I mean, getting back into town. I remember sitting with Paddy Barkley, and there was a, I can't remember if it was Heineken or Carlsberg were the sponsors, but there was basically a fridge full of beer. And we were like, there's just no point leaving here for a good 2 or 3 hours because it's going to be carnage outside. Yeah, yeah. So we're sitting there necking back the free booze. And then we go outside, we're actually with your predecessor, one of your predecessors, Angus McKinnon.
Oh, yes.
And we sort of just nick a taxi, sort of claim we've ordered it. Because, yeah, it's just, what else are we going to do? Walk 9 miles back.
Well, you've learned
town.
From the best, Billy McNeil.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we get back in the town, and I end up out with Angus. I didn't get back in till, I don't know, like 7 or 8 the next morning. And I remember sort of that night, as I was walking back to the hotel, 3 or 4 hours after dawn, picking my way across that square outside the Alhambra, and just Celtic fans everywhere, this carpet of green and white, of Celtic fans who didn't have hotels, were just asleep in the square. And I remember getting back to the hotel, and it was so hot that I was quite drunk. I couldn't remember what room number I was in, and because it was so hot, I'd sweated off the room number from the key. So I remember going to reception and saying, oh, "I'm really sorry, I can't remember what room number I'm in. I've sweated it off." And she went, and she's obviously had a nightmarish night of pissed up Glaswegians turning up. So I see, son. Can you remember your name?
Yeah, I can remember that one. Well, there we are. Kieran, it's been an absolute pleasure going back over that game with you. Thank you very much, obviously, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure talking about Celtic 2, Porto 3 on Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. For more stories like that, go to theblizzard.co.uk. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.